Hi, everybody. My name's Jackie Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to begin by thanking the committee for asking me to come down, for the lovely fruit in my room, and for just making me feel so at home. I love you all. One of the things I was asked to come down and do is to share with you what happened, what it was like, and what it's like now. I don't like the what happened part, and I like to get through it as quickly as I can, because what it's like right now to me is a miracle. So let me run through you and just qualify a little bit, and then we can get into the recovery part of this. I'm not a native Kentuckian. I was born in St. Louis, Missouri, and I'm the youngest of three daughters. By the time I was in eighth grade, both of my sisters had married and gone to live in their respective homes, and so I was at home with my mother and father, and I was raised pretty much as an only child. I had a very normal childhood, a good student. I liked school. I had friends. Nothing that was written across my forehead saying you were an alcoholic. My father had a drinking problem, and he is now deceased, so I can say that he was an alcoholic. He went to AA meetings, he had a sponsor, and when he died, he had not drank for a very long time. My mother never accepted his alcoholism, and she more or less tolerates mine. She thinks that we're very nice people when we don't drink. That's okay. I've learned to accept that. I really, in the beginning, wanted to, you know, to convert her over to the AA way, but I've learned since then that I can be tolerant to and accept her opinion. I didn't go to college after I graduated from high school. I decided that I wanted to go to work, and I went to work in a real estate and insurance office. I enjoyed working, and I ran pretty much with the kids that I went to high school with. I had my first drink when I was 17, when I was a senior, when I had graduated from high school, really. And I had my last drink when I was 37. I had 20 chuck full years of drinking. From my first drink, I've heard people say I'd had my first drink and I drank alcoholically. I did not do that. I had my first drink and I set it down took two sips, set it down on a desk and never had any more. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I just knew that when my dad drank, there was a lot of trouble in the house. I worked for about a year or a year and a half, and I met a young man, and we started dating, and we started stopping after dates to have a nightcap. He was about 4 years older than I was, and this is how we ended every date. When I would go in for that nightcap, I would order a Coke High because I didn't know what else to order, and I would take, again, a sip or two, set it down on the table, and that was the end of it. One night he commented on that, and I picked up that drink and I chug-a-lugged it. And we got in the car and started on our way home, and I mean, I got sick. I really got sick. And he had to stop the car, and I was embarrassed, and I thought I probably would never see him again. But we did date again, and he asked me a very important question. He said, "Would you like for me to teach you how to drink?" And I said, "Yes." And so we went out, and he told me, first of all, that I had to quit drinking Coke, because Coke is the thing that made me sick. And I had to quit drinking bourbon, because ladies didn't drink bourbon, they drank scotch. And so he told me that if I ordered a scotch and water and I drank it, I wouldn't get sick. And I did that, and I drank it, and I felt very good, and I didn't get sick. And I ordered another one, and I really felt good. And I ordered another one, and I felt great. That was my first experience with drinking. About a year later, the three of us were married. (Laughter) And we continued on a very long, unsuccessful road. I wasn't married very long, and I started getting sick, and I went to the doctor, and he told me that I was pregnant. And it was a very bad pregnancy, and after about 6.5 months, I was taken to the hospital, and we lost our first child, a little girl. I had had parochial training. I was Catholic, and I had a God, and I thought I had a God that I understood. But I could not understand why this God that I knew and loved would take my child from me. And I became very angry, very resentful. And I vowed in that hospital that I was going to start taking care and taking charge of my own life. And I left there a very resentful young woman. I went back to work, and I decided we needed to get a house, and we eventually got one, and I moved in, and 3 years later, we had our first son. He was born prematurely at 7 months, but he was fine, and I brought him home, and he was mine, and I was very pleased, and I figured I did this whole thing myself. And 3 years after that, we had our second son, and I was very pleased with that, because by this time, I knew that I was running my life, and I was doing a very good job of it. After we had the second son, I felt a little cramped in that house, and I decided we needed a bigger house. And so we went out, and we bought a lot, and we had a house built, and we moved into this house that was my dream house. I mean, we had the fence around the backyard, we had the swing set, we had the two-car garage, and I really thought that I had everything in the world that I wanted. Two sons in this lovely house, and my husband went off to work in the morning, and there I was, happy housewife. After about 6 months, my husband came home one night and told me that he had been fired. And he had never been fired before, and he was scared, and I was scared because he was scared. And he started answering ads for another job, and he decided to take a job in Cleveland, Ohio. Well, I had never left St. Louis. My family was there. My friends were there. It just didn't even dawn on me that he'd take a job out of town. And it meant that we had to sell that house, and we had to move to Cleveland. And that resentment grew in me even a little more. He had taken a job where he traveled 5.5 days a week, and I was at home with these two small boys, 1 5 and 1 2. And I had visions of him out wining and dining all his clients, and here I am doing diapers and cleaning house and sitting in a town that I didn't know a soul. And I really got angry. I really got mad. And so you know what every good alcoholic does when they're unhappy. You know, poor me. I drank. I started waking up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning in my bedroom with the snow on the TV and the lights on. And I would tell myself that I fell asleep, but I didn't. I started making drinks at night and drinking them and passing out. All this is in retrospect because I didn't know it when I came to AA. You know, I thought I'd gotten in trouble much later than I really did. But this was the beginning of my drinking getting out of hand and my not knowing it. After about a year, my husband told me he wasn't having so much fun on this job. And he didn't like the traveling. He didn't like the motel rooms at night by himself. He didn't like anything about this job. And so he wanted to change and get something else, and he did. And it meant that we had to move to Detroit, Michigan. I was pregnant at the time, and I was going to go back to St. Louis to have my baby. But it didn't work out that way. They had to take the baby, and I had my first little girl. And she was something that I wanted all my life. I had lost one, and I really, really was pleased when I had this little girl, and she was just perfect. I was happy for about 3 or 4 weeks. And then all of a sudden, it dawned on me that I had moved in this house. I didn't know my neighbors. I didn't have a car. I didn't know where the grocery store was. I really didn't know where I lived. And I got very resentful. My husband came home, and guess what? He didn't like his job. And so he was complaining about the people at work, about the town, about everything. And so I started making these drinks before dinner. And of course, I'd test them before he got home to make sure they were all right. And then when he'd come home, we'd have a drink or two before we ate our dinner. Then we'd eat, and I'd put the kids to bed, and then we'd start drinking. And this is where the arguments started. You know, I don't even remember what most of those arguments were about. But we would start yelling at each other and screaming. I even threw things. And, you know, I don't remember any of that other than it was an ugly scene. It was really an ugly scene. Here I was, a mother of three children, and I was in there acting like some kind of jerk. We stayed in Detroit for a year, and my husband took a job, and it meant that we had to move to Chicago, Illinois. And by this time, I had made up my mind that I was just going to move in, unpack the boxes, put the stuff in the closet, get the kids in school, and I was just going to let the world go hang itself, and I was going to take care of my family. Well, it didn't take me long to realize that I had moved into a real swinging neighborhood. And the gals came knocking on the door with the coffee cups, and it turned out that most of the men worked downtown in the Loop. And they would leave at, say, 6 or 7 in the morning and probably not get home until 7 o'clock that evening. So we housewives that were home had to entertain ourselves, right? Well, we joined the Mother's Club, and we got involved with Cub Scouts, and we got involved with Girl Scouts. We had a bowling league. I mean, you name it, we did it. And all of this involved drinking. We would go somewhere or do something, and on the way home we would stop at somebody's house or go in the backyard on the patio, and somebody would make up some drinks, and we'd sit around and drink. A lot of times we didn't even get up off that patio. The men had come home from work, and we'd call them up and say, come over to so-and-so's house, we're going to eat there. And the kids would play out in the backyard, and it was just so sneaky. It just snuck up on us. I mean, we just really didn't know. We would have a party, and it became commonplace for somebody to drink too much and pass out. And nobody thought anything about it. That was just part of the scene. And I found that, you know, I would go to a party, and I'd drink too much and pass out. And I didn't even think about it. I didn't even think what was happening to my life, what was happening in my family, how my kids were getting out of hand. Never dawned on me. In Chicago, I learned what the martini was, and I thought that was probably the most elegant drink that anybody ever served. One, that was pretty, and two, it got me where I wanted to be faster than anything I'd ever put in my mouth. And my husband and I, he decided he liked gin martini, and I decided I liked a vodka martini. And we started buying our vodka and our gin in half-gallon bottles. And we started arguing over who was using whose booze when we had company. And I started running to the drugstore in the middle of the week to get a smaller bottle to fill up my bigger bottle so my husband wouldn't know I was drinking more than him. You would think that I would know something was wrong. No. Wrong. Didn't know a thing. In Chicago, I must tell you, after my daughter was born, the doctor told me that I couldn't have any more children. I had lost 6 children other than the 3 I have. And he said that was enough, and I began taking the pill. When I moved to Chicago, I went to a doctor, and he examined me and told me that my blood pressure was very high and that I should see an internist. But I didn't bother to do that because I was having, quote, so much fun. And one day I was sitting in my family room and my whole left side went numb. And they took me to the doctor or the hospital. And they told me that I had had a light stroke as a result of high blood pressure, as a result of taking the pill. And I saw this as God reaching down again and hitting me on the head flat and saying, all right, this is for you. I'm going to zap you. And, you know, just full of anger and resentment and loneliness and bitterness. And I just left that hospital, and I didn't tell anybody thank you for... And they worked with me so hard. I mean, today I don't have a limp. I don't have any sign that I had that stroke. And I never said a word of thanks to anyone. And most of all, I never said thank you to God. I went back to drinking, naturally. I didn't tell anybody about my drinking, and so I went right back where I was. We stayed in Chicago for 3.5 years, and we moved to Des Moines, Iowa. And it wasn't any better. It was a lot worse. And while I was there, I was hospitalized again for what my doctor thought was hepatitis, but wasn't. And he did a liver biopsy, and they discovered how much I drank. This internist told me that if I'd stay in that hospital and take the medication that he would give me, that he could make my liver like new. And so I stayed in the hospital, took the medication, went home and recuperated, went back to his office, he checked me out, and he said, now if you lay off those martinis, you've got a long life ahead of you, a happy life. And I thanked him, and I left his office, and I went to the nearest drugstore, and I bought a bottle of vodka and a bottle of vermouth, and I brought it home, and I mixed some martinis, and my husband and I drank to my good health when he got home. You didn't have to tell me that I was insane when I got here. I was afraid you'd find out. We only stayed in Des Moines for a year. We moved back to Cleveland. And I believe that the last 3 or 4 years of my drinking was really downhill all the way. And this was my bottom. This was my absolute bottom. We hadn't been there long, and we had a summer where my father died suddenly of a massive heart attack. My father-in-law died of a heart attack. My brother-in-law died of cancer, and he was 42 years old and had 3 young children. I felt as though my world was falling apart. I felt lonely and disjointed, unhappy, miserable, sad, wondering why I was even alive. The only thing that helped at this point was booze. And then I called a doctor, a psychiatrist, and he supplied me with the pills. I had Valium, I had Librium, I had scotch, I had vodka, I had beer, I had everything that I could take and put in my body to numb my brain, to numb my feelings, to just make me get up and walk. It got worse and worse and worse. I'll describe just one day, and most of my days went like this. I would get up in the morning and sit at my dining room table. And my husband would get up, and he would have a suit and a white shirt and a tie on, and I would look at him, and I would hate him. And he would walk into the kitchen, and he would make coffee, and he would drink some coffee, and then he would go to work. And sometimes he would say goodbye, and sometimes he wouldn't, and I really didn't care. And then my oldest son would get up, and he would go in the kitchen, and he would try to fix breakfast for himself and his brother and his sister. And they would all come in and they would sit down at the table with me. Nobody said a word. Nobody said, hi, Mom. Good morning, Mom. Nobody said anything. And they would eat their cereal or their toast or whatever he fixed. And then my older son would pick up the stuff off the table and he would bring it back in the kitchen, run the water over it and put it in the sink, and the two little ones would go back in their room and finish dressing. And then that daughter that I always wanted would come out and sit on a chair, and my oldest son would come in and he would tie her shoes and he would get a comb and he would try to comb her hair. And I would sit at that table and I would watch that, and I would hate me. I would hate me. I couldn't even take care of my own children. I was locked up in this box, and all I could see was see. But I couldn't talk. I couldn't be heard. I couldn't say what was wrong with me because I didn't know. those kids would leave in the morning on the school bus, and they would come home at night. And sometimes their mother would be passed out in the living room floor. Sometimes she'd be in the bedroom, laying on the bed, zonked out. Sometimes there would be smoke all through the house because she tried to go in the kitchen and fix some dinner and couldn't do it. That was my bottom. That was my bottom. I eventually went to that psychiatrist that was sending me out to Librium and the Valium and all that stuff because one day I couldn't get out of the chair. I could not get up. I could not talk. I could not move. I could not do anything. And my husband put me in the car and took me to his office, and he said, hospital. Well, he didn't mean a general hospital. He meant a psychiatric hospital. And I was there for 6 months. They told me that I had a problem with living, and if they could solve my living problem, there would be no more need for me to drink. I had every pill known to man. Uppers, downers, go to sleep, wake up. Whatever they wanted me to do, they just gave me a pill for it. And after 6 months, they sent me home to a husband that I hated, to kids that I hated, to a house that I hated, and they told me to get well. And you know, I tried. But like any full-blooded alcoholic, one day it just got to be too much. And I picked up a drink, and I knew that that was the beginning of the end. I knew that I would be right back where I started. And so I decided that if I were dead, my husband would go out and he would meet this lady, and he would fall in love with her, and she would meet my kids, and she would like my kids or love my kids more than I did. And that they would get married and everybody would live happily ever after and I'd be out of the whole rat race. So one day, when my husband was going out of town and my kids had gone to school, I collected every pill that I ever had in my house. I took every one of them. I made myself a good stiff drink and I took that drink and I went in my bedroom and laid across the bed. And I knew that when I went to sleep, I wasn't going to wake up, and it was the happiest day I had had in years. But that same God that I thought was snapping me in, giving me all this problem, made my husband call from the turnpike when my son came home from school. And he said, is everything all right? And he said, everything's all right, but Mom's sleeping funny. And my husband turned around and came back, and they discovered what I did, and I wound up back in that psychiatric hospital. I tried suicide 3 times. And believe me, it was not a bid for attention. I wanted to die. I truly did. And I almost made it that first time. I think I woke up maybe 3 days later. And they told me how lucky I was that I wasn't dead. And, you know, I didn't believe them. I wasn't lucky. I didn't have a lucky day in my life. But on one of these visits to the hospital, I met this little Irish lady that was about 5 feet tall, and her name was Peggy. And she would come up to me and she would say, you're an alcoholic. I didn't really care what she called me, and I learned not to argue with people in a mental hospital. And she would carry the big book around with her, and she'd say, now we're going to a meeting tonight. And they had a meeting in the hospital, and the only reason we went is because they had coffee and donuts. And I was so zonked out on medication, I can't tell you what even went on. And when I would get out of the hospital, ladies in AA in Cleveland would come over and pick me up and take me to meetings. And I had no idea what was going on, other than the fact that I knew when you went to an AA meeting, you didn't drink. But you see, they told me I was a nervous, high-strung person and I would have to take medication for the rest of my life. And so I could go all day without taking a drink, but you know, I had a Valium morning, noon, and night, and I had a, you know, a pick-me-upper and a put-me-downer and my sleeping pills from the night before. So really that one day of not drinking wasn't too bad. But now if you would have asked me to put 2 days together, it might have been a little problem. So every week I went back to the AA meeting and I had a new sobriety date because I would drink all week and go to the meeting on one night. I continued to do this, and we lived in Cleveland for about 4.5 years. And my husband took a job in Louisville, Kentucky, and he had to get out the map to show me where it was because I'd never heard of Kentucky. And we packed the boxes. My mother had to come and move us. My mother had a garage sale. My mother packed the boxes. My mother cleaned the house. My mother did everything because, you see, I was not capable of doing anything. I was a thing. I was an it. People put me places, you know. People talked about me. People talked around me. People talked over me. People talked at me. But, you know, I really wasn't counted for much of anything. I was a thing. I was a thing. We moved to Louisville, Kentucky in October. My mother stayed until the day after Thanksgiving. And I'm quite sure she stayed that long because she wanted to make sure that my kids had Thanksgiving dinner. We took her to the airport, and I was positive that when she left, I was never going to see her again. And what really scared me is I really didn't care. I didn't care if I ever saw her again. From Thanksgiving Day until December the 18th, 1972, I have no idea what I did. I know I went to the grocery store. I know I cleaned my house. I know I washed. I know I drove my car. But I have no recollection of what I did during that period of time. But on that morning, I came downstairs in my home, and there was a newspaper on the kitchen table, and there was a box, and it was outlined in black, and on top of that box was the word HELP in bold black print. And underneath the word HELP was the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't even think about it. I walked right to the telephone, dialed that number, and talked to Bill W. in Louisville and told him that I needed help. And I have no idea what he said to me other than the fact that he told me a joke. And I laughed. And he said, "See, you can't be that bad. You can still laugh." He told me that a lady had come out and see me and take me to a meeting. And I hung up the phone and I promptly forgot that. I didn't drink that day, but I did take my medication because, you see, I'm a nervous, high-strung person, and I have to take that for the rest of my life. And that afternoon, the doorbell rang, and I opened it, and there was this lovely lady standing there, and she said, "My name's Helen, and I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. Can I come in and talk to you?" My house was a mess. I was a mess, and here's this pretty lady standing there. And she came in, and we sat down, and we talked, and she talked. I had no idea what this lady said. But after a period of time, she stood up, and she said, "You know, I really am sorry." But she said, "I'm having company tonight." And she said, "I've got a few more things that I've got to do." But she said, "I promise you that I'll have someone call you and take you to a meeting." And she left. That lady didn't realize what she did by apologizing to me. Because as I told you earlier, I was a thing. I was an it. Nobody apologized to me for anything for a very long time. And in my head, the thought came that maybe somewhere on this whole wide world, there is somebody that cares. You know the story from here. I went to my first meeting. I have no idea what was said. I saw the smiling faces. I felt the love in the room. They told me to come back, and I came back. They told me to get a sponsor, and I got a sponsor. They told me to get a home group, and I got a home group. I did most of what they told me to do, maybe not so willingly, but I did it because I had nowhere else to go. Plain and simple. I had no other choice. The first step of this program was a gift to me, and I really believe that. There was never a doubt in my mind that I was an alcoholic or that my life was unmanageable. There was not one doubt in my mind that those two things were not absolutely true. I had the desire to drink for maybe 6 months, 7 months after I was in this program, and then that left me. And then I had the miseries, you know, the miseries. I was in for, maybe a month. I can't tell you because I was really goofy. But we were coming home from a meeting one night, and the lady that was to be my sponsor was talking, and she said something about not taking pills in AA. She didn't say it to me. It was in the course of the conversation. And when I got home, I thought, you know, I haven't had anything to drink for a while. I'm a member of AA. And so I'm not going to take those pills anymore. And I took them and I threw them out. And the next morning I got up and I thought, that's a very bad idea. So I went to the waste can and I was going to get them out of my waste can and it was empty. And so I thought, that's okay, they're in those little plastic containers, they're in the garbage can, I'll go out and get them there. I opened the back door and stepped out on the porch, and my garbage cans were upended at the street. The garbage man had come. Now, you see, I'm a lady that's tried to commit suicide a few times, and nobody's going to give me a lot of pills. And those doctors are counting those pills out. They're not going to give me more than a month at a time. And I threw them all out. And so that day, I became a full-fledged member of AA. And that night, I thought I was going to die. And the next night, I thought I was going to die. And a week or so later, I told the ladies in AA what I'd done, and I thought they were going to kill me. I don't ever recommend anybody going off pills that they've taken for any period of time without help, without supervision, because I literally did think I was going to die. I really did. And at that point, you know, it really didn't make any difference because I was that sick. After I got off all the chemicals, the booze, the pills, I would say that probably my first birthday was my clearest day in that year. You know, I'm so envious of the young people who come in and can get with it and start working these steps, because my 20 years of drinking, and especially my last five, did a lot of damage to me, did a lot of damage. And so it took me a long time to come back and to get my thinking processes together and to get my act together. And the one thing that I've always said, the only thing that kept me coming, the only thing that held me, the only thing that sometimes keeps me going now is the love that I found in this program. Because I was literally taken in the arms of AA and just hugged for as many times as I needed by the women in this program. You know, I was a mother, I was a wife, I was a daughter. I thought I knew what love was, and I didn't know anything. I didn't know anything. Love is saying, are you going to a meeting tonight? I'll stop by and pick you up. Love is saying, do you want to go shopping this afternoon? Love is saying, how about going to a conference? Love is saying, how about coming over for a cup of coffee? Love is saying, hey, I love that new dress. Love is saying, I like the way your hair looks. Love is saying, how long have you been sober now? Love is saying, y'all come back now. I mean, I've never, ever experienced the love that I've experienced in this program from everyone. From everyone. I was here for about a year, and in my second year, I was in my home group, and there were two members of my home group. That was the home group. There were about 40 people that came to the meeting, but only two members of the home group.
And they said, we need an intergroup representative. The other home group member said that to me. So guess who was the intergroup? So I went for a year, and in the first few meetings, I thought, my God, these people are going to kill each other. I mean, they were really going at it. And I came back to my sponsor, and I said, you know, I don't understand this. We all love each other, and we do this. And she said, well, everybody believes what they believe. And in AA, you can stand up and say what you believe. It might not be right, but you can stand up and say it, and people will accept it. And then you all fight like hell, and then whoever's right wins, and then you all go out and get coffee. And you know, I found that's true. No matter where I go, that's how it winds up. That's every meeting I've ever been to. I stayed in intergroup for about 2 years, and the same group member said, now we need a general service representative. And same song, second verse, I went into that. Only this time it was a little different. When I live in Louisville, I live on the east side of town. And when I was an intergroup representative, I learned all about the south end of town. I learned about Indiana. I learned about places that I had never gone in the city. Because, you know, I just didn't travel too much. We get in AA and we get in that little cocoon where we're comfortable and we stay there. It's a nice, warm, loving feeling. And to go to the other side of town or go across the river to Indiana is a big adventure. And I did that in intergroup. Well, when I got to be a GSR, somebody said, well, we're going to Owensboro. And I said, Owens where? And they said, we're going to Owensboro. And so I learned in the state committee that, you know, there's Owensboro, there's Hazards, there's Somerset, there's all kinds of cities with the same AAs, with the same meetings, with the same love, with the same concern about AA, with the same arguments. Everything's the same all over. And it was so exciting, and I'd go back to my home group, and I'd say, you've got to do this. And they finally got to the point, it had grown by then, and we got newer members, and I started doing a little 12-step work, and all my pigeons had to join my group, you know. That's how I got it to grow a little bit. And I'd go back, and I'd be so excited about this, and they'd say, oh, my God, Jackie, don't get involved in anything else. You're driving us crazy. But I was just so enthusiastic about what I was learning about my state. And as I said earlier, I was a general service representative, and I was a district committee person, and I was elected as the secretary treasurer of our area assembly. Then we called it our state committee. And I was just so full of AA, and I was so full of love. And, you know, we read how it works at every meeting. But I felt like every time I walked in a service meeting and something was done, I was finding out why it works. Why I can disagree with you. Why you can disagree with me. Why this thing is 55 years old in the next year. You know, that's the beauty of it. It's lasted 55 years, and nobody's fixed it yet. You know? It just keeps rolling along, just like the river. Anyway, I was fortunate enough I stood for delegate. I stood for delegate, and we went through 3 ballots, and there was no winner, and so we said, we'll go to the hat. And my name went in the hat. And the very man that I called December the 18th, 1972, was a past delegate, walked up to that hat and pulled out my name. How about that? Only in AA could that have happened. And he walked over to me after that meeting and he said, well, kid, you must be doing something right. He was a fine man. He was a fine man, and I loved him very much. I went to New York, and when they read that roll call of the United States, and they said Kentucky, and I said here, I wish I could describe to you how I felt. This is a lady who was legally diagnosed a manic depressive, who was a thing, who was an it, who was a nervous, high-strung person that had to take medication the rest of her life, that stood in that room and accounted for a whole state. And you all did that for me through the love that you give me in these meetings. There is no way that I can ever give back enough. No way. To just even out the feeling I got when I did that. I try to explain to people coming into this program that the unity, the service, and the recovery, that triangle is ever so important. Because I was told when I came that I could accept a half a cup and go to my meetings and that's it. Or I could want a whole cup and get involved in service and in the things that make this thing run. I never took a half a cup of anything in my life. And I'm certainly glad I didn't take it in AA. I went to a service meeting a few months ago. I guess it was back last January. And they were saying that we needed a new Southeastern trustee. The election was coming up. I was asked to stand for that, and I said, no, that I can't. I was in school at the time. I had gone back to a business college to take some computer courses and stuff like that. And I was going to get out of school and I was going to go to work, and I felt like it wouldn't be fair to my husband to be gone so much, and to the year that I had spent in school, I wanted to use the knowledge that I'd gotten. And I had all these excuses in my head. And I explained it very carefully to the people that talked to me, and they shook their heads and they understood. And the next morning, when we were all asked to stand and say whether we were going to stand or we weren't, I went to stand and tell everyone, and I sincerely mean this, I was going to say I refused to stand. And my husband took my hand and looked at me and he said, go ahead and do it. And I said, what? And he said, you're never happier than when you're in service. You're never happier. And I said, but you don't understand. And he said, yes, I do. Stand. And so I left my name on the ballot, and I sent in my resume, and I thought, no way. No way. And I promptly forgot it. Honest, truly engine. After a week or so, I talked about it to a few people, and I said, oh, there's so many people that have stood for that. I don't have to worry about that. And I put it away, you know, and that never, never land in your brain. One night, I came home, and we've got one of these little recorders. And one night I came home, and there's all these hang-ups on my recorder. And I thought, my God, somebody must have really been trying to call me. And on the very last call, this gruff voice comes over my recorder and he said, this is Paul. I'm in New York. You got it. I'll call back. And all of a sudden, I realized that was Paul Hart, our delegate. Poor man had been trying to call me all day, and he was telling me that I had gotten the election of Southeast Regional Trustee. And I was in a state of shock, believe me. Really, truly was. I walked around for a couple days and, you know, the phone kept ringing and really, really nice people called and wished me well and offered me help. And I went down and spent 2 days with Joe Phelan, and he kind of ran through things for me and gave me a little bit of help. And I met his wife, Elaine, and Janet rode down to Atlanta with me. And we went to their roundup, and then I got ready to go to New York, and it was that same feeling. I wish I could tell you what it's like. The only way you're going to learn is if you do it. So, you know, I got a whole room full of Southeastern trustees out here. But you pack that bag and you get on the plane and you get off and you walk in that hotel lobby and it's all of a sudden you get this little feeling. And you go to the desk and you check in and you're supposed to be at a certain room at a certain time and you walk in that room and some guy walks up to you with a big smile and sticks out his hands and says, "Hey, I'm Joe. I'm so glad you're here and you're home. And you're home." And the love is in the room, and the caring is in the room, the concern is in the room, and you're off and running again. I said this morning in the meeting that I serve AA as a whole when I'm in New York. And I bring the feelings, I bring the questions, I bring the complaints of the people in the Southeast region there. I'm concerned about your welfare and the welfare of AA when I'm in New York. I really can't stress this too much, that it's up to you if I do a good job. And I've never asked help from a group of AAs that I haven't gotten it. And I feel truly that I'm asking your help tonight to help me be a good trustee. Tell me your feelings. Tell me your complaints. Tell me your ideas. Tell me whatever you want to get to New York. That's what I want. That's my job. And I want to do my job. I didn't tell you this in my story because I wanted to get into service. 5 years into the program, I divorced. I was single for 4.5 years, and I remarried an alcoholic in the program. And we've been married almost 7 years now. He has 4 children. I have my 3. Christmas Eve around our house is a little nutsy, but we have a good time. We have a very good time. And what we both brought into this second marriage is the love that we both learned in AA. And there isn't any way that I can tell it any different. He respects me, I respect him. He has his opinions, I have mine. He has his program, I have mine. We have all program people for friends. I mean, it's been a marriage made in heaven, and I'm very, very happy. And I'm loved. And I know how to accept that love now. My oldest son is 30, going to be 31. He's married and lives in Sumter, South Carolina. He's a chemist, really. He's about 6 hours away from getting his degree, but he's a chemist. My second son is 27 years old. He lives in Louisville. He got married about 3 years ago. Neither one of my sons have children. My daughter is 24 years old. She graduated from college 2 years ago. She lives at home with me right now, or my husband and I. She's turned into a real neat kid. She is very compassionate. I don't know how else to describe her other than to say that she's a young lady that I love. And that love is returned to me. And AA gave me that. She has very long brown hair. And when she was in high school, the young girls in her crowd started French braiding their hair. And she came to me one day, and she said, "Mom, do you know how to French braid?" And I said, "Yeah." And she hopped up on the chair, and she said, "Braid my hair." And when she was in high school, I used to get up at 6:30 in the morning and braid my daughter's hair. And you all gave me that. I did it 2 days ago. It's a great feeling. It's a great feeling to be loved. and it's a great feeling to be able to love. This morning in that meeting, there were a lot of hands of GSRs that were brand new, and this was their first state assembly. I wish you all well, all of you that are new. I hope you continue to come to your assembly. I hope you continue to be active in your home group. But the one thing I hope that you'll receive and that you'll keep and that you'll pass on is the love that we have in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Jackie, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.